Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Orange Theory, let's turn it up.
You can never stop me.
Are you ready for the life-changing fitness experience that helps you redefine your limits? You are faster here, you are stronger here, and you get more results here. Because here, you have the coaches, community, and group energy coming together to push you forward every class. With scientifically designed full-body workouts and technology to track your results and prove you're improving. Welcome to Orange Theory Fitness. Book a free workout today at orangetheory.com. See studio for details.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Monday, the 9th of January, these are our main stories. Thousands of supporters of Brazil's recently defeated President Jair Bolsonaro have invaded the National Congress, Supreme Court, and Presidential Palace. President Joe Biden is visiting the US border with Mexico for the first time since taking office. Ukraine has dismissed as propaganda Russia's assertion that it's killed hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers in a rocket attack. Also in this podcast.
It doesn't so much look like a flying car as it looks like a small aircraft. The cabin is kind of set up like a four-seater airplane.
So what exactly has been revealed at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas? We start in Brazil, where thousands of supporters of the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, stormed the National Congress in Brasilia on Sunday. The sound of tear gas being thrown at supporters by police, who retaliated by throwing projectiles back. In an echo of the January 6th insurrection in the US, some protesters reached the Senate chamber, where they jumped onto seats and desks. Others invaded the presidential palace, Supreme Court, and government buildings. Katie Watson is our South America correspondent.
Well, I think this is something that a lot of people feared ever since Lula won October's elections. It was a very divided election, a very close race. What we've seen are reminiscent of the January the 6th invasion of the US Capitol by supporters of Donald Trump. There was a mounted policeman pulled from his horse by the crowd. There were doors and windows broken to access Congress. Tear gas fired. This is just showing how strong the opposition is to Lula and how these protesters are not giving up their fight for Lula to leave the presidential palace. And I think that's the biggest concern that we're seeing playing out in Brasilia.
And are these supporters like the ones on January the 6th in 2021? Do they think that the election was stolen, or are they just really, really cross that Bolsonaro didn't win?
So in a way, it's very much out of the Trump playbook. Jair Bolsonaro's nickname is Trump of the Tropics. He has always shown his admiration for Donald Trump. But I think there's certainly a Brazilian twist in this, and that is that it's not just an anger that Jair Bolsonaro lost. I've been speaking to protesters because these protesters have been camped out at military barracks across the country since the elections. It's not just happening in Brasilia. It's here in Sao Paulo, where I am as well. And speaking to them, a lot of them saying that, you know, Bolsonaro is gone. You know, this is more than Bolsonaro. The system is broken and they don't want communist Lula back in power. Lula is not a communist, but that's what he's frequently accused of being, a communist. And these people say that the only way to save Brazil is military intervention. And that's something that they feel very strongly about. It's only the military that can save Brazil and sort out the elections that were stolen from them. This is a country that has seen military dictatorship in the past, but it's also a country where that military dictatorship, that period, is denied by people and actually seen as an era of order and stability by many far-right supporters. So they want that back because they don't want Lula back in power.
And what has Lula said?
He's actually on an official visit in the state of Sao Paulo, where I am. But he has declared federal intervention in Brasilia and obviously condemned the attack. I mean, this is worrying, obviously, for Lula. These are people he's going to have to contend with for the next 4 years as president. But it's also worth saying that Hamilton Mourão, who's the former vice president under Jair Bolsonaro, even he, on the eve of the inauguration, criticised Jair Bolsonaro for saying that leaders who stay silent sow the seeds of chaos in society. And there's been accusations from Lula, from Hamilton Mourão, and now, you know, even his own people, that his silence or his encouragement, criticising of institutions such as Congress, such as the Supreme Court in Brasilia as well, has led people to disrespecting the system so much that they're now willing to attack it. And that's something that many people here thought would happen, but they just didn't know when.
In a live television address, the Brazilian president described the protesters as fascist vandals and said they would be punished with the full force of the law. President Biden is in Texas for his first visit to the U.S. southern border with Mexico since taking office. He's meeting officials in El Paso for discussions about the record number of migrants and asylum seekers there. The president has faced criticism from some Border Patrol officials because of his relaxation of former President Trump's strict border policies. So what's been the reaction on the ground to President Biden's visit? Our correspondent Sophie Long is in El Paso.
I'm standing on a corner where hundreds of migrants have gathered. They have been sleeping on the streets here. It's bright sunshine now and actually quite warm, but it's very, very cold in the mornings and, of course, overnight. There are two buses that are parked on the street here. They're stationary and they're just there so people can go into the buses and warm up for a couple of hours. Opinions of his visit, as with everything else in America at the moment, very much divided. Some people are applauding his efforts to come and witness the situation for himself. Others, though, say this is just political posturing ahead of another presidential election looming on the horizon in 2024. And a lot of people, of course, saying it's too little, too late. Republicans in particular have been urging him to make this trip since he came to power. He was, of course, elected on a promise to have a more human approach to immigration. Well, if you look at the camps on the Mexican side of the border and the camps that have sprung up over the months of his presidency on this side, on the US side of the border, there's very little indication that that has happened.
That was Sophie Long in Texas. One of the best-known Cold War spies caught by the United States has been released from prison in Texas after more than 20 years in custody. Ana Montes spied for Cuba for almost two decades while working at the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency. Vanessa Heaney reports.
Ana Montes has been described as one of the most damaging spies the United States has ever found. Unlike many other high-profile agents who were caught during the Cold War, she was motivated by ideology rather than personal gain. Investigators say she was first approached in 1984 by a fellow university student after expressing outrage at the Reagan administration's activities in Latin America. In particular, she was against U.S. support for the Nicaragua Contras, a right-wing rebel group suspected of committing war crimes. When she was later introduced to a Cuban intelligence agent at a dinner, it said she unhesitatingly agreed to work through the Cubans to help Nicaragua. In 1985, Montes began working for the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency and quickly became its top Cuba analyst. For almost two decades, she met Cuban handlers every few weeks in Washington, D.C. She received orders by shortwave radio and she sent back top-secret information using coded messages on a pager. Ana Montes was finally arrested in September 2001 after U.S. intelligence officials received a tip that a government employee seemed to be spying for Cuba. Officials said she had almost entirely exposed U.S. intelligence operations on the island. A year later, she pleaded guilty to conspiring to commit espionage as part of a plea deal and was sentenced to 25 years in prison. Montes will be placed under court-ordered supervision for 5 years. Her internet usage will be monitored, and she is barred from working for government or contacting foreign agents without permission.
Vanessa Heaney, Ukraine has dismissed as Russian propaganda claims by Moscow to have destroyed a building in the eastern city of Kramatorsk, killing hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers. Moscow said it hit the target with a barrage of rocket fire as revenge for a deadly strike on a Russian barracks in eastern Ukraine last week. Hugo Bacheva is in Kyiv.
Let me just go back to what happened last week, because it helps us understand what's happening today. So on New Year's Day, there was a massive Ukrainian attack on a facility in a town under occupation in Donetsk. This facility had been turned into a base for Russian troops, and dozens of Russian troops were killed. The Russians had to make a rare admission, perhaps because of how catastrophic this attack had been. They've acknowledged 89 deaths. The Ukrainians say that up to 400 Russian soldiers had been killed. So this was a massive Ukrainian attack targeting Russian forces today. The Russian Defense Ministry said that in a revenge operation, it targeted two facilities in the city of Kramatorsk, which is a city under Ukrainian control, and that more than 600 Ukrainian forces had been killed in what the Russians are describing as a massive rocket attack. The Ukrainians have denied it. They say this is another piece of propaganda. This is a city that is under Ukrainian control. We haven't seen any evidence to suggest that a massive attack took place. The mayor did say this morning that the city came under attack overnight, but he said that there were no casualties. So what we're seeing from Kramatorsk is that there's no evidence that this attack has taken place. And I think what is interesting here is that the Ukrainian attack sparked a lot of criticism from military bloggers, Russian military bloggers, who become very influential in this war, and also from Russian politicians. And today, after this Russian claim, these military bloggers are again criticizing the Russian Defense Ministry, because they say, well, this is a lie. So the evidence doesn't seem to support the claim that this massive attack has taken place.
It kind of shows you just how important this control of information is in this war.
Exactly. And I mean, we've got to say that the Ukrainians also have a very efficient operation in terms of trying to shape the narrative of what's being said. So they rarely claim responsibility for attacks inside Russia or on Russian-controlled territory. But in Russia, the entire narrative is controlled by the Kremlin, is controlled by pro-Putin outlets or these military bloggers who have become very influential in this war. But it's incredibly difficult in Russia, and for some people perhaps even impossible, to get any kind of independent, reliable information of what's happening here.
Hugo Bacheva. The Palestinian foreign minister says Israel has revoked his VIP travel permit, a pass which enables Palestinian officials to travel easily in the occupied West Bank. Riyad al-Maliki said the move is Israel's latest retaliatory step following last week's Palestinian bid to involve the International Court of Justice in the decades-old conflict with Israel. Here's Mike Thompson.
Israel's new Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made no secret of his anger at Palestinian efforts to get the International Court of Justice's view on Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. His office described the move as waging political and legal war. On top of withdrawing VIP passes from top Palestinian officials, Mr. Netanyahu's right-wing government has already announced restrictions on Palestinian construction in the West Bank and the use of nearly $40 million of PA funds to compensate Israeli victims of Palestinian attacks.
That was Mike Thompson. Police in Germany have arrested an Iranian man suspected of preparing an Islamist attack using highly toxic substances, cyanide and ricin. He was detained in the city of Kastrop-Reichsel near Dortmund. James Menendez spoke to the BBC's Paul Moss and asked him for more details of the arrest.
We know that this was as a result of a raid which took place just before midnight local time. Police arrived in fire engines, we're told. Now, there's some confusion here. There's a suggestion this was to create an element of surprise. Others have suggested there actually was a real risk of fire because they suspected that some kind of chemicals were around. Two people, in fact, were taken into custody. We know that one is a 32-year-old Iranian. It's been suggested the other was his brother. But we're told he was plotting some kind of attack which involved cyanide and ricin. The chief public prosecutor in Dusseldorf, Holger Hemming, has now revealed that the raid happened as a result of a tip-off from the intelligence agency of some allied country, they wouldn't say which, and that they acted very quickly. Police now say they actually didn't find any toxic substances at the residence, though they seized lots of what they call electronic storage media, presumably that's hard drives, mobile phones, etc., and they're still considering whether to bring the suspect before a judge.
What is ricin, and has it been used before in this kind of attack or plot?
It has indeed, and in fact in Germany 5 years ago, a Tunisian couple living in Germany were found guilty of a plot which they were planning to carry out on behalf of the group which calls itself Islamic State, and that was using ricin. Not just Islamists, though. In the 2010s, there were letters laced with ricin sent to various American politicians. But this is far from new. In fact, the American military were looking at using ricin, would you believe, back in World War I. The trouble is, ricin is very hard to control. It's derived from the castor beans, which are actually, it's actually a misnomer. These are seeds, the castor plant, very easy to grow. There's lots of it around. It's used to make castor oil. And the main thing about ricin, as yet, there is no antidote. It is almost always fatal.
That was Paul Moss. Still to come.
I grew up in a very small village where we had a very small ski lift and we just went there skiing after school. And I really grew up like that. It's really part of the culture.
We hear from residents of alpine ski resorts who are wondering what the future holds as the local climate heats up. Residents of a town in the Indian Himalayas have been moved from their homes after hundreds of houses began developing cracks and sinking. Disaster management officials have said parts of Joshimath are unsafe. Our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Etarajan, told us more.
This particular town is in the Himalayan region. It's about 2,000 metres above sea level on the way to very scenic trekking routes in the Himalayan mountains and close to China border as well. Now, the local residents have been protesting for years, warning the authorities that these cracks are developing and they need to look into that. And it was very common for people to move out of their houses during monsoon season when it really pours, because that's a dangerous time to stay inside the homes. People were staying even in tents outside. But now the problem is becoming more acute. In the last few weeks, more than 600 buildings have developed cracks. It's triggered panic among residents. They have been moved to hotels as well as relief centres. Now this is getting national and international attention. And the people are blaming various construction work, development projects. But at the same time, their immediate priority is because, you know, land is premium because it's a very small area. So where will they go? Where will they find the houses, alternative accommodation? But the first priority is to, it's a cold month, winter time. They want a safer location where they can have, you know, warmth as well as food. And that is what they're asking. But the fear among the residents is that the town is slowly sinking.
Yes, because presumably they can't just go back to their homes now. They have to be moved somewhere else.
The government, various governments have been discussing about this project of relocating these people. We're talking about thousands of people. But the authorities are faced with different issues like finding alternative accommodation. At the same time, because this is also an ecologically sensitive region, whereas people have been objecting to various activities, it's a classic case of how a beautiful Himalayan place where you have too much of development activity, for example, two huge hydropower projects coming up nearby. They're digging huge tunnels. And there's a highway also going, passing through. It goes all the way. And it is a tourist site as well. So unplanned construction work. And these are really having an impact on the town itself. Now, the biggest threat is about what will happen to these houses. If not, the government has to come out with an alternative plan. And that has not been happening.
Ambarasan Etarajan. In the past week, parts of Europe have recorded record warm winter temperatures, including places which would normally be blanketed in ice and snow by now. That's been bad news for alpine ski resorts. In Switzerland, some have closed their slopes altogether, while others are relying on artificial snow. Climate scientists say warmer, wetter winters are likely to become more frequent. So what will that mean for the mountain communities that rely on winter sports for their livelihoods? Imogen Fuchs reports from Bern.
It's snowing, it's snowing, a cold wind is blowing. A song children growing up in the Alps know well.
I grew up in a very small village where we had a very small ski lift and we just went there skiing after school and I really grew up like that. It's really part of the culture.
Markus Roller is co-director at the University of Bern's Tourism Research Unit. He can see the Alps from his window, but the view this winter is worrying.
What we see now is very high temperatures for a very long time, so it's going for weeks now, as we see that. And we see a lack of snow. There was not much snow from December left, and we see that a lot of skiing areas basically do not have snow at all.
Es ist 10 vor 10. Guten Abend. Viel grün im Weiß.
The warm, wet weather is making headlines. Alpine winter resorts were hoping for a great season after so many pandemic closures. But Christoph Marti, a climatologist at Switzerland's Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research, warns this winter is not a one-off.
We already had this situation for two other winters in the last 10 years. And it's pretty striking that it's already now the third winter with such low snow and warm temperatures. As a climatologist looking at the last 50 years, it's obvious that there is really a change going on.
How will alpine resorts cope without snow? In Adelboden, scene of this weekend's World Cup ski races, head of slope preparation Tony Hari is perched in a cable car, looking down on a narrow, slightly muddy ribbon of snow surrounded by green pastures.
We're looking at the steepest part of the run now. Preparing this is a huge challenge. We're going to have to push higher altitude snow down to cover it, then pack it all down with the piste bashes. The plan is to let the warm weather have its way, and then hopefully it will get a bit cooler and we can spread out the snow.
Adelboden, a big resort, also has an army of snow cannon, and it's determined to hang on to winter sports. But other smaller resorts still rely only on nature for their snow. In some, like Splügen at 1,500 metres, once considered snow safe, the slopes are closed. Ski lift director Hacher Berne says there was no choice.
Look at this snow. It's really wet, like in spring. For skiing, the snow needs to hold together. There's just too much water in this. It's impossible.
And Markus Roller, the tourism expert, says alpine resorts must now face this painful reality.
I guess at least 50% of them won't be ski resorts anymore. Some will try to survive, but we have very short seasons. I think the only solution is that a lot of them have to go out of business one day.
But with more warm, wet winters predicted and thousands of livelihoods dependent on tourism, climate expert Christoph Marti says the impact of losing skiing could be much wider.
In regard to climate change, there are much, much bigger consequences. A few Swiss with ski, who cares? For some valleys, some communities which are heavily dependent on this winter tourism, and this ski area has to close. This means that not just skiing will stop there, it may also mean that the school will close, the bakery will close, so there is a whole chain of consequences.
Imogen Fuchs in Switzerland. A notorious South African apartheid minister, Adrian Vlok, has died at the age of 85. The former law and order minister played a key role in enforcing the racist apartheid era, which saw a brutal police crackdown on opponents of white rule that included bomb attacks on churches and trade unions. But speaking to the BBC in 2017, he claimed he knew nothing about the hit squads that had been run by the police.
The heat squad and all these people, I know nothing about that. They were not under my command. I didn't give them any instructions. But the figure of about 30,000 people detained, I think that was possibly a correct figure. But you know, if you take into account that during that 5 years, we had more than 80,000 incidents of violence, petrol bombs and hand grenades and shootings. So it was a terrible situation.
Flock confessed to some of his crimes after the apartheid ended and was granted amnesty, a move critics labelled as a stunt. Will Ross is our Africa regional editor, who told me more about Adrian Flock.
Effectively, he was in charge of the police force, and this was a time when the government in South Africa was trying to stop the resistance to white minority rule. So there was more and more anger amongst the majority black population as more and more oppressive rules were put in place by the apartheid regime to try and keep apartheid going. So part of the work that Adrian Flock oversaw was, you know, pretty brutal police tactics that went on, including hit squads that kidnapped and tortured activists. There was also the bombing of some institutions, including the bombing of the offices of the Council of Churches in 1988. And interestingly, for that particular bombing, he, after the end of apartheid, he went to the Truth Commission and he admitted this crime had been carried out, this bombing, and he took responsibility for it. But some of the things that happened under his watch, possibly ordered by him, he didn't own up to, including an extraordinary plot, an attempt by the police to murder the anti-apartheid cleric Reverend Frank Chikane. There was a very strange plot back in 1989 when the clothes of Reverend Chikane were poisoned in his suitcase as he boarded a flight to go abroad, and he survived that. Years later, Adrian Flock sought forgiveness from Reverend Chikane, and he went and actually washed his feet as a kind of an act to seek forgiveness.
That was Will Ross. Now, is it time to get those flying goggles? Has the impossible happened? For many years, people have dreamed of the future where we travel from city to city in a flying car. Well, one is now available to the general public for pre-order after its working prototype was unveiled at this year's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. It's called the Asker 5, and you can put your name down for $5,000. Though there is another catch. You'll need another $750,000 when you get the car. James Menendez spoke to Asker's founder and CEO, Guy Kaplinski. So what does the flying car look like?
So it's a good question. It's look more than an airplane than a car. So, but it's a true flying car where you have a vertical takeoff, conventional takeoff, and you're driving on a road.
I mean, it struck me when I was looking at a video. It's a bit, I mean, if people can imagine it, it's a bit like a sort of giant drone in a way, isn't it? In the sense that when it's flying, you've got what? How many rotor blades going round lifting it up? About four, is that right?
It's a six propeller.
Six.
And we have very large wing, which give it to fly like an airplane. So it's a drone, but it also fly like an airplane.
And what is your thinking about what this will be used for? What was your idea when you came to design it?
The plan was find a solution that helped to reduce the cost of living. And then we looked to many technology, and then we decided to go into transportation because we felt that transportation is not being changed for last 100 years.
And how will it help with cost of living? Why is this a cheap way of getting around? I mean, given that it's not mass transit.
So our vision is to expand the suburb to 100 kilometers to 150 kilometers, and that will enable people move from a small apartment in the city, where in the U.S. is about $1 million to $2 million, a small apartment, into the suburb where you can buy for $300 or half a million dollars a beautiful house outside. According to a study that we made in the U.S., we will save about between $1,000 to $3,000 a month if you use our transportation and move, because you pay less for your mortgage and less the expense.
That was the founder of the flying car, Guy Kaplinsky. James also spoke to Bree Fowler, senior writer at the US technology website CNET, who was at the Las Vegas show and saw Asker 5 up close.
Well, it doesn't so much look like a flying car as it looks like a small aircraft. The cabin is kind of set up like a four-seater airplane, but then it has this pair of enormous wings with propellers on them. And this allows it to do vertical takeoffs and landings, kind of like a helicopter more than an airplane.
Yes, I was going to say, I mean, we've got helicopters, so I just wonder how much this moves things on.
I think what it does is it flies longer. It's electric. It gives it more range and also allows it to, you know, maybe even land in your driveway. They're thinking that, you know, they'll start an Uber-like service in 2026, and then with the goal of making it fully autonomous by 2030.
And what do you think about that? I mean, all I can think of is if it were to take off and were to get regulatory approval, which is obviously, you know, potentially a long way off, that, you know, you'd have the skies over cities just crowded with these things. I mean, it'd be chaos, wouldn't it?
I think that is quite the issue. I mean, that regulatory approval is going to be a giant hurdle. They act like it's going to happen very quickly, but that remains to be seen. I mean, we've seen flying cars at CES for years, and, you know, none of them have been able to really get off the ground, so to speak. What they are hoping is that if these are autonomous, then they would be able to communicate with each other, and therefore you wouldn't have traffic issues, worries about collisions, things like that. Until that happens, you're going to have licensed pilots, and they're going to have to be directed through aircraft control, just kind of like a small aircraft would be.
I mean, also, I mean, one can imagine that if you're a, you know, a billionaire living on a ranch outside San Francisco and you want to get into town, this would be a great way to go. And as you say, it is electric and potentially more sustainable. But if you've got hundreds of thousands of people trying to commute into New York City, I mean, they can't all go on one of these, can they?
No, I mean, and I asked the company that, and, you know, they said that there is much more space in the air than there is on the ground, and that these aircraft would have the ability to maneuver around each other. And certainly you would only see a few, usually probably the billionaires, doing this at first, and then it would slowly scale up. But, you know, ultimately they're talking about making this, you know, just as common as me calling an Uber or a Lyft, that this would appeal to families and allow them to move further out away from city centers and, you know, ultimately cut a 100-mile commute down to 30 minutes.
That was the US technology writer Bree Fowler. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.
When the dark comes rising, six shall turn it back. Three from the circle, three from the track.
The Dark is Rising is the audio adaptation of Susan Cooper's classic fantasy novel into a spellbinding 12-part family drama.
Wood, bronze, iron, water, fire, stone.
Listen on headphones for an immersive 3D audio experience.
Five. Return and one go alone.
The Dark is Rising from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
We have been waiting for you for a long time.
Orange Theory, let's turn it up.
You can never stop me.
Are you ready for the life-changing fitness experience that helps you redefine your limits? You are faster here, you are stronger here, and you get more results here. Because here, you have the coaches, community, and group energy coming together to push you forward every class with scientifically designed full-body workouts and technology to track your results and prove you're improving. Welcome to Orange Theory Fitness. Book a free workout today at orangetheory.com. See studio for details.